Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, national and international, all the factors that shape our jobs, our incomes, our taxes, our debts, the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. And I also write columns for truthout.org, a remarkable, independent, courageous source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. As always, I want to remind you about our two websites, where you can find additional information, links, an archive of all of our radio programs, an endless array of materials I think will interest you if you find this program interesting. The first website is rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available to you at no cost, 24/7. They contain materials designed for your interest and to help you understand the economy. They both provide ways for you to communicate with us, questions, comments, criticisms, you name it. We read each and every communication, and we encourage you to make them. We do ask you understand that when we select one or two to be responded to at the end of each program, we have to make that selection because we get many more communications, for which we are grateful, than we could possibly answer individually. So finally, do take advantage of these websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And please as well note that you can sign up there for the free newsletter we send periodically during the year, often with materials that I write specially for that newsletter. And also you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Today's economic updates begin with the state of Wisconsin. It's a state that has gotten a lot of attention because a very conservative, business-oriented governor, Walker, and the Republicans took over that government a few years ago. So it was with great interest that I took a look at the recent labor contracts worked out or about to be signed in that state, because it gives us a sense, a few years into this new kind of government, what it means for at least one part of the working people in that state. Wisconsin has about 69,000 state employees. They've gotten no wage increase for the last 4 years. Last July, the non-unionized workers, which is the vast majority, got a 1% increase. Nothing for 4 years, and now a 1% increase, which I believe they have for the next 2 years. 1% increase is less than the rate of increase of prices in the United States, consumer prices. So you got nothing over the last 4 years, during each of which the prices of goods and services rose. And now you're going to get 1%, which is less than the projected rise of consumer good prices. In other words, public employees are able to afford less and less. In the language of economics, the real wage of public employees in Wisconsin has dropped. They are paid less in terms of what they can buy with their wage year after year for 5 years. It's extraordinary. And the union folks, affected by a law in 2011 called Act 10, which doesn't allow unions to bargain for anything other than cost of living increases, they're going to get the same 1%, which means that the unionized workers will fall behind in terms of their real wage, just like the non-unionized workers. Now, what will be some of the effects in Wisconsin are important for everyone to understand, because if this happens in other states, the effects will be multiplied. If you cut the real wage of workers, especially 70,000 state employees, there's going to be less goods and services that they can afford to buy. That means the customers going into the supermarkets and the drugstores and the restaurants across Wisconsin will have less that they can buy in those establishments than before, which will hurt each and every one of them. Those restaurants, those drug stores, those hardware shops will then lay off workers, reduce their hours, hurting their incomes, who in turn will be able to buy less. You see the process. In effect, the governor of Wisconsin, by carrying out with the Republicans this attack on public employees and public employee unions, hurts the economy of Wisconsin across the board. And what does he get in exchange? He doesn't have to raise the taxes as much as he might have otherwise. Yes, but this doesn't change or negate the impact of cutting the real wage of a mass of workers. Now, of course, he could have, but not as a Republican and not as a conservative, he could have taxed wealthy people and corporations in Wisconsin. He might have. He might have carefully chosen them, because he might have figured out that what you do in hurting the economy if you tax them is less than the damage done to the economy by cutting the real wages of 70,000 people. But that would go against his ideology, because he needs to believe that pandering to the already wealthy and the big corporations is some sort of magical bullet that will help the economy, even if you're cutting the real wages of 70,000 people. Economically, there's no empirical evidence to support this. This is a pure ideological assertion. The evidence runs the other way. And the decency of it all? Well, I don't need to comment on that. My next update has to do with a provision in the federal tax code. It's one I would guess most of you have not heard about, so I want to be the first one to bring it to your attention. It's called, and don't worry about this, you don't have to remember it, the Walton, as in the name of the family that owns Walmart, the Walton Grantor Retained Annuity Trust. Grantor Retained Annuity Trust works out to GRAT, and that's what this tax provision is called, a GRAT. GRAT. If it sounds like a rat, you're getting it. GRAT. What does the GRAT allow you to do? It's basically a technique to avoid paying gift tax. In the United States, the law says if you give gifts over $5 million, roughly $5 million, you have to pay a tax, a gift tax. It's exactly like the estate tax. When you die, you can leave $5 million plus to your descendants, your heirs, your beneficiaries. But beyond that, you have to pay a hefty tax in the neighborhood of 40%. By the way, what's the idea of this inheritance and gift tax? It's called the idea of the level playing field. The idea is, in a democratic society, everybody should sort of start with the same resources, the same chances. And so let your merit, let your capability, let your ingenuity, let your energy, let your smarts carry you. But we do not believe, or at least we say we don't, in giving some people a huge advantage by being able to inherit a ton of money from somebody else so that they have opportunities other people don't. They have help other people can't afford, etc. We want to start with a level playing field. Everybody kind of at the same starting point, so it's really only your energy, your commitment, your achievement, your capability that determines where you end up. So one of the ways you do that is you have an inheritance tax, so that even if you become wealthy in your life, you don't unfairly advantage the next person, your children, relative to other people who were just had the bad luck of being born to someone who might love them but doesn't have a lot of money. Put that aside. We have, as a matter of law in the United States, an estate and a gift tax designed to accomplish a level playing field. But what we have in reality are ingenious people who have a lot of money and whose commitment to the democratic ideals of the United States, whose commitment to the notion of a level playing field, is exactly zero. Their focus is getting around it. So imagine my interest and what I thought I would bring to your attention when the Bloomberg Financial News Service on the 18th of December carries an article with a bizarre title. I'm going to read you the title. Accidental tax break saves wealthiest Americans $100 billion. I love the word accidental. They want us to believe that what I'm about to describe to you was an accident. Wow. Here's what the story explains. There is a lawyer, and the reporter for this story interviewed him, named Richard Covey, C-O-V-E-Y. He pioneered this GRAT maneuver. He's very open and proud about it. The IRS has validated it, at least for the time being. So let me give you some examples of the results. Sheldon Adelson, a big owner of casinos in Las Vegas, particularly the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, one of the world's richest men, worth more than $30 billion, famous because he gave a lot of money to a variety of Republican candidates in the last presidential election. He makes use of the GRAT, Lawyer Covey's invention, to how to get out of paying gift tax. So according to the Bloomberg story, over the last few years, Mr. Adelson has given $7.9 billion to his heirs. Had he been required to pay the gift tax as it was intended, he would have had to pay $2.9 billion in U.S. gift tax since 2010. But by using the GRAT, he avoided that. So let's be clear. He enables his heirs to start not on a level playing field, but one so steeply tilted that none of us is ever going to see anything like what those young people begin with. And he's also deprived the federal government by himself of billions of dollars, forcing the federal government either to find that money from the rest of us, we pay more because Adelson pays less, or, if they won't go after us, to cut the government services for child care, for hospitals, because Mr. Adelson has escaped the tax. I want to give you a list of some of the other people, according to Bloomberg, who have made very attractive use of the GRAT way of avoiding gift tax. Facebook's chief executive officer, Mark Zuckerberg, he's made use of it. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, has done it. J.P. Morgan Chase Company, a huge bank in New York, helps so many clients use the GRAT trust that the bank has a special unit dedicated to processing GRAT paperwork. According to one J.P. Morgan private wealth banker, I have a client who's done 89 GRATs just by himself. Wow. Charles Ergen, chairman of the Dish Network, and fashion designer Ralph Lauren, have passed more than $300 million each using GRATs. You may not get out of your taxes, but I thought you'd be interested in how other people manage to do that. Okay. Last update for today. The war on poverty. Back 50 years ago, we had a war on poverty. And we hoped it would work. And an interesting reflection on the 18th of December in the New York Times, Eduardo Porter talks about how we really haven't come very far, that the poverty rate in the United States 50 years after the war on poverty is more or less where it was back then. And he makes some interesting points I wanted to bring to your attention. First, that what seems to be the ongoing problem is the private sector. It simply does not provide enough jobs, and it simply does not provide enough jobs at a decent salary or wage to avoid poverty. Between companies leaving the United States and going abroad where they can pay even less, and replacing people with computers and machines, and simply taking advantage of unemployment to offer workers very low wages, whatever the combination of causes, the private sector hasn't done anything in 50 years to overcome poverty. To the extent that poverty has been reduced, it's overwhelmingly due to the government. This is the interesting part of this story. The private sector cannot provide jobs and incomes at a reasonable rate to most people. And so the government steps in with Social Security, with food stamps, with Medicaid, with a whole host of programs that help people and so lift them out of the poverty conditions they would otherwise experience. I have only one thought to add. Not only is the government what keeps millions of Americans out of the poverty that the private system would otherwise condemn them to, but we have changed our tax laws over the last 50 years. The government that keeps people from being poor used to be sustained by high tax rates on the rich and high tax rates on corporations. That was what it was like back in the 60s and 70s. Since that time, taxes have been reduced on the rich far more than on anybody else, and reduced on corporations relative to individuals. So while we have not done much to get rid of poverty, leaving the private sector free to provide too few jobs at too low wages, but we have also made sure that the burden of trying to prevent more of our citizens from falling into poverty, a burden borne by the state, is now paid for much more by middle and lower income people than by rich corporations and wealthy individuals. Nothing much to be proud of, but something that should have been added to the story of a retrospective on the war against poverty, a war which, clearly, the United States has lost. I want to turn now to major discussions for today. And I want to begin with a topic that doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. And I want to begin with a story from Boulder, Colorado. And in Boulder, Colorado, over the last little while, something remarkable happened that deserves much more attention than it has gotten, which is one of the ways I select material for this program. Voters in Boulder, Colorado, the home of the University of Colorado, approved an initiative to end the city's relationship with Xcel Energy, XCEL, a utility that earns $10.7 billion in revenues, a large utility in that part of the country. The voters decided they want the city of Boulder to set up its own electricity generating facility and to make more use of renewable natural energy. Now, this ballot for the voters was actually put on before them by the opponents of this effort. They wanted to prevent the city council from simply proceeding to socialize on a city level the production of energy, to make it a public company, not a private company. They also wanted to block the city from issuing enough bonds to enable the city to buy the facilities of Xcel Energy so that the city could itself produce and distribute electricity. I'm proud to be able to report to you that the effort to kill this initiative by the opponents failed. The people of Boulder, Colorado, by a landslide vote, two-thirds in favor of socializing the electrical utility. Now, I want to talk to you about what that means. First of all, municipal utilities are very common in the United States. They serve over 50 million Americans. One in six Americans gets his or her electricity from a municipal producer, a public service, not a private company. Wow. Most of these utilities are owned by cities. But in some cases, and by the way, when they're owned by cities, local citizens, elected or appointed by the city administrations, run the utility and are responsible to the community for how they do that. But there are some examples where the city has managed to set up a city-owned electric utilities run as a cooperative. That is, run under the supervision of the city, but run by the workers themselves who produce the electricity. So you get an interesting set of possibilities there. Why is this interesting? Now, the answer is that public utilities, which are very popular where they've been established, which is one of the reasons there was so much fighting against it in this case. Here's what they do. First, they are much more creative in seeking ways to save energy because they are not in the, ready, profit-making business. They're interested in two things: reducing the costs of electricity to the citizens of the town or the city, and secondly, in reducing the damage to the environment that comes from energy industries in general. So they explore renewable sources of energy, and they explore all kinds of ways to save on energy because profit is not their bottom line. Number two, they deliver electricity more cheaply. That's right. Their rates are lower than private rates, and one of the reasons, again, is they don't have to earn a profit. They're not in the business of making profit. They're in the business of serving the community. There are no shareholders who have to get dividends, none of that. And finally, what a public utility does is if it is efficient and if, even though it charges lower rates, it can economize and actually achieves a profit, here's what they do with the profit, so unlike a capitalist corporation. The municipal utility gives the profit back to the city. It's a revenue for the city. It means the city can tax its people less because it's getting a profit income from the electric utility it runs. Instead of the profits going to investors far away, it stays in the community, and it immediately helps the community, just as the lower rates and the shifting to renewable energy sources helps the lower community. It's a win-win for the people. It's a loss for private capitalism. And isn't that the war in which we are all engaged, consciously or otherwise? Let me turn next to another major conversation. This one has to do with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. 20 years ago, we entered into a new arrangement between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. There would be free trade. We would not have our borders be places where you couldn't cross with goods and services or had to pay high taxes. A free trade area, as it's called around the world. Glowing reports were issued by those who wanted it about the enormous benefits to the United States and to Mexico and to Canada from doing this. Free trade, as so many of my fellow economists desperately need to believe is some sort of magical guarantee that everybody wins. It's usually the case that if someone tells you that everybody wins, you ought to look really closely at a deal. It's like that saying, if a deal sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And if something has no losers, it's probably like one of those deals that's too good to be true. And NAFTA surely was one. The estimates are that 700,000 jobs were lost in the United States because of companies that moved out of the United States into Mexico because the conditions created by NAFTA made that profitable. And it became a kind of template, a kind of model for what American corporations would then do in subsequent years elsewhere in the world. Move to where conditions were more profitable, leaving behind workers without jobs, communities without income, governments without revenues, all the disasters ultimately exemplified by places like Detroit, Cleveland, Camden, New Jersey, and so on. And NAFTA had other consequences. Around the United States, companies could say to their workers at bargaining time, hey, you better give us some concessions. Allow us to give you fewer holidays. Allow us to make you pay more for your medical care program. Because if you don't, we'll go to Mexico. And enough companies had done it that this threat was credible, that this threat frightened unions and workers. So we can't even measure how many job conditions deteriorated for American working people over the last 20 years because of what NAFTA made possible, the systematic exodus of American companies to Mexico. But it did more. It also shook up Mexico. It made it possible for American products, corn from our Midwest, department stores like Walmart to enter and destroy competitively thousands of little bodegas across Mexico. The result in Mexico was a mammoth loss of income and jobs for Mexicans, many of whom, as a direct result, had no option left but to leave Mexico and to move north into the United States to find the work that NAFTA had helped make disappear for them inside Mexico. In other words, the loss of jobs inside Mexico from NAFTA overwhelmed the increase of jobs in Mexico from American companies going down there, with a net result of stimulating a mammoth emigration of Mexican people from their home country to the United States. Now, did it make possible the production in Mexico of goods that could be shipped back into the United States, creating jobs for truckers to move back and forth? Yes. Did it help in the sense that it cheapened certain products in the United States because companies could make so much profit by paying Mexican wages, a small fraction of their American equivalents? Did Americans benefit by some cheaper goods? Yes. In other words, it's a complicated story. But there's one thing that isn't complicated at all. When you look at the movement of jobs from America to Mexico, you see American corporations more profitable, which is why they made the move, because they could pay lower wages. And when that produced an emigration of Mexicans to the United States, it again gave American corporations, staying here in the United States, the opportunity to substitute low-wage Mexican immigrants for what they had formerly paid Americans. So the one thing that's clear is businesses benefited because wages in general dropped if you went to Mexico and dropped relative to what you were paying in the United States when you could either threaten American workers that you'd leave to go to Mexico if they didn't take lower pay, or fire them and substitute or bring in immigrants from Mexico. Capital won from NAFTA. Labor lost. And the losses of labor were not seriously offset by having a cheaper pair of pants or a cheaper good coming in from Mexico. May have made the pain less, but that's all it did. NAFTA was a win for capitalism and a loss for the majority of people who work in that system in both countries and indeed in Canada as well. We are halfway through the program. We're about to take our break. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Please rejoin me in a matter of seconds.
You know I'm bad at communication. It's the hardest thing for me to do, and that's it. It's the most important part that relationships will go through. And I give it all away just so I could say that. But I know, I know, I know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. You know there's no rhyme or reason for the way you turned out to be. I didn't go and try to change my mind, not intentionally. I know it's hard to hear you say it, but I can't bear to stay. And I just know, I know, I know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. Always keep your heart locked tight. Don't let your mind read by. Oh, but I just couldn't take it. I tried out and I to beg it, but I fumbled. And when I came down through the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. Oh, but I fumbled. And when I came down through the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. Oh, but I fumbled. And when I came down through the wire, it's your imagination. You make it what you want it to be. Because I'm sorry I do what I did, but it came naturally. And I gave it up away just so I could say that. Well, I know, I know, I know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. When I tried to keep myself together after all the opportunities, I tried to stay true to you and I tried to do what you wanted from me. And I gave it up away just to hear you say that. Well, I know, I know, I know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. Always keep your heart locked tight.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. As we head into the second half of our program today, I want to remind you, please, to take advantage of our two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. Again, both of those websites have freely available materials for you to look at, to pursue the kinds of analyses we do on this program. Both of these websites have facilities for you to send us your suggestions, comments, criticisms, and questions. And both of them allow you to sign up for our newsletter that brings this sort of material to you via email a few times a year for your interest, all again at no charge. And likewise, please remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. We continue with a major discussion, and this one has to do with the Federal Reserve's announcement that it's going to taper its quantitative easing program. Now, I know that sounds like technical jargon, which it is. So let me explain briefly what this means. The United States government, since the great crash that began in 2007, has been actively stimulating and supporting the economy of the United States because the private sector either cannot or will not do that. This has to be understood. The federal government, for example, is spending billions, hundreds of billions of dollars more than it takes in. That's in order to stimulate our economy. It's not as much of an excess of spending as it used to be because conservatives are pushing against it. But let's not forget For the last 4 or 5 years, we have had, in most cases, more than $1 trillion of excess spending by the government, spending more than it takes in order to stimulate the economy, to provide jobs to people who wouldn't otherwise have one, to provide purchases from all the businesses of America who otherwise would have much fewer purchases made and therefore be laying off more of their workers. The government is crucial, but it has been reducing its stimulus. Alongside what the government does in terms of spending money, there's what the Federal Reserve does in terms, basically, of lending money, providing credit. And the Federal Reserve has been creating money, pumping money into the economy in the ways that it normally does, at an enormous clip, so that we have the federal government, the Treasury, spending more than they take in taxes to stimulate, and the Federal Reserve pumping money into the economy through the banking system to stimulate it that way. The first is called fiscal policy, stimulate the economy, and the second, monetary policy. But the Federal Reserve announced that it is about to reduce its provision of new money. That's what quantitative easing is. It's a fancy way of saying pumping money in. And they're tapering it. That is, they're reducing it over the 2014 year. Every month, apparently, it will be reduced a bit. But that's interesting because the Treasury is reducing the stimulus from fiscal policy. The gap of spending over taxes is being reduced, and the Federal Reserve is reducing. In other words, the government, both branches, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, fiscal policy and monetary policy, are less helping the economy. This is justified on the grounds that we are in a recovery. So let's comment. First, the recovery has bypassed most Americans. So what the government is doing is providing less support to an economy, even though this is the worst recession in 75 years since the Great Depression of the 30s, and despite the fact that most Americans have not seen their situation improve. The improvement has been for the very top. They don't need more help, but the rest of us do. And the government has decided that this recovery for them is a sufficient reason to back off on its stimulus for the economy as a whole. There could be no more democratic or undemocratic, to be more correct, way of proceeding. What I meant to say, there could be no more dramatic illustration of whose interests prevail at the Federal Reserve and at the Treasury. But let's go further. Tapering, reducing the amount of stimulus. What else is going on in the Federal Reserve? Well, there is another concern. And while some people need to make believe this isn't real, I disagree with them, and I want to explain to you what's at stake. The Federal Reserve has increased by trillions the basic amount of money in our economy. It did that over the last 5 years to stimulate the economy because the private capitalist system was in a tailspin into disaster. So the government stepped in and rescued the private sector. That's something the private sector hates to face, hates to admit, hates to think about, and hates to see as a sign of its own weakness. But I don't have any of those hesitations. The government stepped in because the private sector collapsed, and the Federal Reserve has pumped money in. One of the great fears of the Federal Reserve is if it didn't pump money in, that there would be a deflation, that the economy would sink into such a depression that nobody could afford to buy anything, and that companies faced with people unable to buy would cut prices in order to sell the stuff they had produced and had built up as inventory. And if all the prices start going down, this becomes a kind of self-reinforcing process in which you have a general drop in prices. And that's deflationary. And that means everybody has in their mind, my goodness, maybe I shouldn't buy something I was thinking of buying because if I wait a little while, it'll be cheaper. So that the deflation builds on itself, produces more of the behavior that brings the deflation about. This is terrifying and can really implode an economy. So the Federal Reserve pumped money in to make people have more money so that we don't have a deflation. But the problem is that economic policy, being the rough instrument that it always was, that when you pump up the money supply, you also create a situation where, potentially, all that extra money sitting in the accounts of banks and other kinds of financial corporations could at some point actually start being lent out by people who use it to buy things. And if all of that extra money begins to chase land, houses, real goods and services, it'll drive up their price and we will have an inflation. Now, our economy has been so depressed for so many years now that we haven't had any inflation. Our big problem is a weak economy in which businesses cannot raise prices because nobody can afford to buy this stuff. But there's the potential that all that money hanging over the economy, as it were, could come in and create such a problem for the economy. And that is a serious issue. So the Federal Reserve, in a sense, is worried about an inflation with all that money, worried about a deflation because the economy remains weak, and yet is tapering because I guess it has decided that the risk of inflation and the pressure from conservatives who need to believe that the government should get out of the economy, even though that's what's holding it up because of their ideology. So we have this tapering. Will it work? No one knows. Will it prove to be awful idea, counterproductive in the worst sense? Perfectly possible. Nobody can see the future. The Federal Reserve is afraid either way. The fragility of a capitalist economy is suddenly revealed. We have millions of people out of work, 10 to 20 million, depending on how you count. That's a disaster by itself. We have 20% of our tools, equipment, and raw materials, our capacity, sitting idle. That's a colossal waste. And we have an economy that therefore can't produce the wealth that those unemployed people, if they worked with that idle equipment and raw materials, could produce. That's a disaster. On top of it, we have a government that doesn't know which way to go and is flying blind most of the time and has now decided, having supported an economy for 5 years, that they can or should reduce that support. But believe me, the honest ones in Washington, they know perfectly well that they're taking a chance. That's why they waffled about this tapering all of 2013. And they're now not even going to taper suddenly, but very gradually, because they're so unsure and because the terrain is so dangerous. Could they have behaved otherwise? Of course they could have. Notice that all the stimulation is from the top. You put more money in the banks. You spend more government money on big corporations, which is where most of it goes. Could you do it otherwise? Of course. We have that example in the Roosevelt years of the 30s, when there was a movement from below to have a different kind of stimulus. So we created the Social Security system, unemployment. I've gone through that so many times, you don't need it again. We stimulated from below, not just stimulus from above. We saw prosperity trickle up from helping the people at the bottom in the 1930s. And here we are at the end of 2013, waiting for the trickle down of a policy that hasn't worked for most people and that still hasn't trickled down. And we've been waiting, and we've been waiting, and we've been waiting. All right. We've come to that portion of our program that we come to every week, where I try to respond to questions and comments that you've sent in. The first one that struck me, that one of you sent in, that I appreciate, had to do with the AIG Corporation, American International Group. At the time of the crash of 2007 in the United States, AIG was the largest insurance company in the world. And it was a very powerful sign. in the United States when it turned out that all of the extremely risky speculations that had been done by the financial sector, not only in the United States, although the United States took the lead, but many other banks in many other countries got involved in this speculation. It had to do with creating new securities, they were called asset-backed securities, in which you gambled, you speculated on the mortgages being written for millions of Americans who had questionable finances in terms of whether they could ever pay them back. But this was kind of hidden or suppressed information. And meanwhile, these speculations went crazy. And as they went crazy, the speculators decided that they themselves, knowing how risky their investments were, needed insurance policies so that if something went wrong, they would be covered. So they went to insurance companies like AIG, and they wrote a special kind of contract with them called a credit default swap. And what this contract did was basically commit AIG, and other entities were involved too, it wasn't only AIG, but it committed AIG and entities like that to basically provide an insurance policy. So if you speculated in mortgages, say in Sheboygan or in Chicago or in Cleveland, and the people who had these mortgages couldn't pay, say because they lost their job in the American unemployment, you wouldn't have to worry about not getting your piece of the action because you had this insurance policy. But of course, an insurance policy is only so good as the capacity of the insurance company that issues the policy to make good on it. AIG had written policies on which it could not make good. And so suddenly, in September and October of 2008, as mortgage speculations were collapsing around the world, the owners of these speculations turned to AIG and said, hey, pay us. You have to make good because the underlying mortgage holders can't make the payments. And AIG turned to these people with whom it had these contracts and said with a smile, have a nice day, but we don't have the money to make good. At that point, literally the bottom of the credit market. Every bank in the world, major bank, had huge amounts of these things on its books. If it couldn't collect on those insurance policies, it had worthless assets. It couldn't pay back its depositors. It couldn't pay off the loans it had taken out to get involved in this business. The banks were collapsing. At that point, the federal government stepped in and basically took over AIG. Very important for me to make this point as clear to all of you as I possibly can. The United States government took over the AIG company. It nationalized it. It socialized it. It did to that company everything it had ever excoriated the Soviet Union for doing to companies in that society, taking them over and running them as government enterprises. That's what the United States did. Much as it did that to General Motors, and much as it did it in a less formal way with all of the major banks. The federal government nationalized large sectors of the American economy because they were collapsing as private capitalist enterprises. They had taken risks which failed. They had failed to have enough resources to cover the risks they actually faced. If this is a sign that they were incompetent, the government managed to pretend that that wasn't the case, because the government pledged when it came in there, providing them with, as it turns out, almost $200 billion for AIG alone to salvage all of its contracts to protect all those banks who had made all those bad speculations, bailing out the failures. Bailing out those who had proven their incapacity to be at the head of a large financial institution. They were kept there, and the government kept them there. Recently, and this is why the story today, recently this issue has become even more painful for those of us who have some sense of what's going on. AIG has made the remarkable statement that it paid back the benefits and help it got from the government, and has used the fact that the government ended up earning more money on the AIG help than it paid out. $10 or $20 billion more the government got back at the end than it laid out. And this is taken as a sign that somehow AIG has, like a criminal, paid its debt to society. Well, it hasn't. And I want to explain to you how and why it hasn't. A small part of what the federal government did for AIG was the actual loans it provided to them. Those AIG has paid back. The real gain to the government has been the gain on shares of stock, because it took over the stock, 80% of it, of AIG as part of bailing that company out. And it has been able to sell the shares of stock at more money in the years since it took over AIG than it paid initially into AIG to get those shares of stock. The profit has been in the shares. Why did the shares go up that the government held? Answer, because of everything else the government did. It's the government that bailed out all the banks with whom AIG did all of this credit default swap business. It's the government that flooded the economy with the money that could go back in the stock market and raise the prices of stocks, even though it didn't do much to create the jobs that unemployed need. But it boosted the stock market. And with it, the government boosted the stock market, including the shares of AIG that the government had and could periodically sell. It's the government that raised the price. It's the government, at considerable expense to the American people, that was able to make that project work. Not because of AIG, but despite AIG. It's AIG's failure to have the reserves in the first place. It's AIG's inability to adequately measure the risks it was taking. It was AIG's utter bankruptcy that brought the government in. For 5 years, the government ran that company as a defunct company while taking all the steps to recoup its benefit. The idea that the government should withdraw from AIG because it has repaid what it borrowed and is therefore, in some sense, free and clear is outrageous. Everything that AIG did argues that the government should never get out of the insurance business, that that company put the whole country and the whole financial sector at risk, that it, like the major banks, couldn't adequately measure risk, couldn't and didn't adequately adjust and provide reserves in the event that their estimates of risk proved wrong, as they did. That's the job of a bank and an insurance company, to assess risk. They failed, and the government had to rescue them, and the government fixed it up, this hobbled capitalist system, and was able to extract itself without losing money. But what it did in the process was lose control, which is much more important. You're giving back the insurance company to the same private capitalist profit-driven system that brought us to this disaster in the first place. There's nothing to celebrate here. And there's certainly nothing to credit the AIG Corporation. They didn't provide profit to the government from its rescue effort. That's 100% what the government took risk to do and achieved. AIG was a problem at the beginning, in the middle, and now at the end. Last item for today. A listener writes in and says, is perhaps the problem of the American labor movement connected to the fact that manufacturing jobs have been leaving the United States and we've become more of a service sector economy? I guess the short answer to that is I don't think so. In other words, yes, part of the reason the United States is turning away from manufacturing has been the success of American manufacturing workers to win with many struggles, decent wages, decent contracts, decent benefits, over 100, 150 years of struggle. And yes, it's sad to say, but the way a capitalist enterprise responds to workers who have successfully raised wages is to try to figure out a way to get around that. And the way that American manufacturers figured that out was to leave the United States and go to where workers are willing to work for much less. And yes, that cripples the very unions that were successful in getting those wages up to have the American worker have a decent lifestyle. But nothing is fundamentally different in the service sector. In other words, the same thing can happen there. Indeed, today, it's the service sector that is better organized than the manufacturing sector, and particularly public services, where the unionization rate is many times larger than what it is in the private sector, manufacturing and services combined. Intrinsically, unions can work in a service sector too, and they do in many parts of the world. So I think that the trick is to figure out how to re-energize the union movement more than it is to worry about the split between manufacturing and services. The issue is the capitalist way of doing this and what it means for working people and the contradictions in that system. Thank you as always for your attention. I appreciate very much that you listen to this program. The flood of your communications to us is enormously encouraging. Please continue it. Know that we read each and every one. I look forward to seeing you again next week on Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, thanking you again.
But after a while, gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.